Thank you, Nort, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I have to make a brief health announcement here first. One of the rules of good teaching, there should be no mannerisms to interfere on the part of the speaker with his communication with the audience. And I'm afraid I'm going to have to violate that egregiously today and for a couple of days, subject you to every variety of mannerism, sneezing, sniffing, coughing, inhaling various sprays, sipping, sitting, standing, perhaps leaving the room and coming back. So I'm recovering, I hope, from a variety of things which shall be nameless, but I sped it up as much as I could, but no amount of wonder drugs has had any effect, although I'm on them all and they've just created more symptoms. So if you would be good enough to indulge me and try and ignore this tremendous difficulty, maybe in a couple of days I'll get back to normal. I'll be able to talk louder and faster and catch up for what we lose. So thank you for your indulgence. All right, now again, officially, good morning. I'd like to welcome you to these sessions. I want to start by saying something about my book. I'm very happy that that is finally close to reality. I will be submitting the final completed edited manuscript to the publisher in September, maybe October, and it'll be out about 11 months after that. I just have editing left, editing of a few chapters and footnotes, that's all. I finished the actual writing last March. I want to tell you at the outset a specific assignment in writing the book, so you'll know what to look for and what not to look for, and what I want our procedure here to be. The purpose of my book was something that has not heretofore been attempted, and that is to offer a proper academic presentation of objectivism, with all of those words central, proper academic. So what is a proper academic presentation of a philosophy? Well, in no special order, here are the points that I want you to be aware of. First, my intention was to be comprehensive. I want an overview of the total philosophy with all of the key interconnections between the principles and the branches. Now, up to now, we've had, you know, what the blind man has with regard to the elephant. One studies one leg, and one studies another, and the tail and the head. Close-up studies of separate aspects. I want to stand back and do the elephant as a total. So instead of a book on politics, a book on epistemology, it's deliberately the scale is such as to present the total as one unit. And I think that gives you a perspective and orientation, a framework to put all the more specialized discussions in that otherwise you wouldn't have. Now, if it's to be an academic presentation, it has to include important technical issues. That's the next point I want to make. Now, there are overviews of objectivism in print, notably Galt's speech, but that, by its nature of a man announcing and defying the world, can't go into the theory of concept formation or the contextual nature of certainty. That'd be out of the question for that context. So I want to put in those technical issues, I have put in those technical issues that I regard as essential to grasping the uniqueness and the overall coherence of objectivism. Now, technical does not mean frivolous. It does not mean of interest only to professors. Technical issues can be, they're not always, but they can be, crucial life and death issues. Technical here just simply means issues not generally known to the public, but only to experts in a field that they've discovered to be necessary to grasp the answers to the key questions. Some of those issues are crucial and have to be in. Others, I may say, are senseless and a proper presentation must rigorously omit them. I'll say something about that in a minute. So there are two different audiences that my book is not aimed at: professional philosophers and complete beginners. Neither would be appropriate audience for this book, and neither would get much out of it. Now, I don't believe myself that anybody should write for professional philosophers. And this is even, even assuming we were in Atlantis and they weren't all eaten by corruption from the lungs out, I believe that philosophers should write for man, for human beings, not for other philosophers, which is a parasitical, useless occupation. I don't mean to compare myself to the major philosophers, obviously, but they wrote Plato, etc., for people. They did not write for, you know, other professors. And of course, so did Ayn Rand. And I'm very much on that line. On the other hand, given what I'm attempting to do, the totality, including the key technical issues, it would be impossible for a complete beginner to philosophy or objectivism to follow clearly what I'm doing. It would be too condensed, too compressed, and there would not be enough chewing if you did the amount of detailed analysis required to make it clear to a complete beginner. It would be multi-volumes, and then we would lose out the ability to take it in one comprehensive unit. And therefore, I am presupposing a general background in philosophy, and above all, a knowledge of Ayn Rand's major writings. Certainly, Atlas Shrugged and The Fountainhead. Now, the third point, besides that it has to be comprehensive and include the important technical issues, since we want to see the whole as a single unit, it has to include only essentials. Ruthless omission is a necessity of writing this type of book. Selectivity. Essentials means that on which everything else depends, that without which you could not understand the whole or the relations of its various parts, as against the endless number of details, applications, elaborations, explications that you could do if you wanted to just let yourself go and say everything that there was to say. In the writing, I continually wrote something, said, gee, that's really good, that's clear, and then threw it out. I've got an entire cardboard carton stuffed full of things marked next book, if ever. There's all kinds of good stuff that I just couldn't use. Sometimes I had two pages, and I would take a sentence or just an adjective, and the rest of it had to go. The question I had to continuously ask is, how many points can a mind retain and still connect those points to every other essential, still keep them all going in the mind and come out with the total at the other end? And as soon as you overload at all, then of course the mind breaks down. My mind first, it's not a reflection on the audience. Anybody's mind breaks down, and you're back to the situation of you just see the elephant leg and you can't retain the total. Now, it would have been much easier and much faster for me to have written 12 volumes of the same length. The book is 700 pages. 12 volumes, one on each of the chapters. I could have batted that out, and I would have had no trouble at all, but then the result would have been like reading 12 books, and somebody would still have to do the digesting to say, well, what is really essential in all this, and what isn't? What is crucial, and what's just derivative? You'd still have to digest it. I myself learned a great deal by asking, does this point have to stay in? Does this section, does this sentence, etc., or can I get rid of it? And to tell you in advance, if something is in there, a subsection or a paragraph or whatever, it means I regard it as indispensable, that you simply can't get away with it if you want to present objectivism. Now, I want to moderate that by saying that occasionally I made a cultural concession. That is, I put a paragraph or a point in that I did not think was essential to grasping objectivism, simply because that particular confusion is so widespread on that point that it would be hopeless for people to understand the point generally if I didn't make that clarification. But generally, I have not made cultural concessions of that kind. I've tried to look at it straight and just put in what is required. On the same token, if it's not in, that means I left it out for a reason, unless it's something I just didn't think of, which is unlikely in 6 years of pondering it full time. So if you don't see either way why something is in or why something is out, that will be a good type of question to ask, and I will be happy to answer. Now, you see from this that I regard a proper presentation as the opposite of a typical academic dissertation. You know, that's where they set themselves exhaustiveness as the criteria. Every conceivable question that anyone from any set of premises, from any viewpoint, in or out of focus, could ask, they answer. Any conceivable counterargument that anybody could manufacture from any aspect, they take care of. Every conceivable trivia is in there. Now, I regard that as unmitigatedly bad. Bad for anybody, bad in itself, intrinsically, if I can use that term. Even if you're a world specialist, it's bad, because it's impossible to follow or hold with the proper epistemology. And it is not a conceptual mode of presenting. It's not in terms of essentials. It hasn't been digested by the author. And in fact, I think it has to be motivated by second-handedness. That is simply, what is it that would appeal to my colleagues and make them think that I know what I'm talking about? Now, I do allow that there's room for highly detailed presentations of philosophy, but only if it's first-handed, and even there, it has to be in terms of essentials. No treatise can possibly cover everything that is possible to say on a given subject, because of one point that I make in the book, which is what?
Yeah. Everything is interconnected.
Very good. Everything is interconnected. All of reality is a total. If you tried to say, and Ms. Rand used to say this, on any one point, literally everything that could be said, that would be tantamount to omniscience, since everything is interconnected. So what happens, then people give themselves the assignment of exhaustiveness, is they just go until they're tired and quit. Now, there's nothing to recommend that, and there's no use attempting it. Now, I stress this because I leave a tremendous amount out, and this is my defense in advance, when you tell me during questions, well, it would have been much clearer if you'd put that in. I've already gone through a preliminary seminar and had all kinds of discussions. Oh, if only you had just said in the book what you just said to me now, I would have understood it. But I have to tell you in advance that if I know those points, but if I had done it, we'd be back to 12 volumes. Now, the next point. This is deliberately a book on philosophy. So I have ruthlessly shunned psychology. I don't attempt to give any motives except very once in a while when I can't resist it. And then just in passing to bad people. I'm not concerned with what's the motive of power lust, for instance, when I get to politics, but is statism the proper system or not? Not what makes somebody a second-hander, but what's the nature and validation of independence, etc. We're approaching all these questions purely as philosophers. And I want to separate philosophy from the whole subject of psychology, which is distinct from philosophy and not our concern. Similarly, presenting a philosophy, I don't try to make current cultural comments. The idea here is an essentially timeless statement, and therefore the opposite of trying to be relevant. This is not a newspaper, and my goal is, if I live 20 years, it should still be viable and not be dated. A philosophy should apply to any realm, occupation, era, and society. Now, again, you can't resist an occasional passing comment, but that is gravy. The substance of it is one tries to make it timeless. Now, a very crucial point from the point of view of questions. That is the order of the points. I've deliberately structured the book hierarchically. That is, first I choose each section according to what I regard as essential, but then the order of the sections is dictated by logic, by what depends on what. That is true of the chapters within the book, the sections within a chapter, and so far as possible, although there's some option here, the material within each subsection. I've always tried to arrange it so that what comes first, and then what it leads to, and so on. So you have the total structure of the philosophy ahead of you. And I've sacrificed drama, interest, color, any other consideration strictly to what comes first hierarchically, logically, and what comes next, like a geometry book, in effect. And I strongly urge that if it's not clear to you why A precedes B in any aspect of my structure, you ask me, because this will be essential to grasping the overall philosophy and the proof of the various points. You should see for each section, you know, the ones that have the running heads, why this section is in, why it's essential, and why it is where it is, how it presupposes the earlier, and itself makes possible the later. If you don't see that, please ask. Now, one last thing with regard to the, I'm not going to do this every day, this long preamble, but just to get us started. Style. I am writing this as a professor, not as a crusader or as a moralist. Now, of course, it is a crusade, and I do subscribe to a code of morality, but I'm not writing in that capacity. To some extent, of course, it's unavoidable when you present depravity to mention in passing that that's what it is. But my goal here is to explain, to try to clarify, not to denounce all the other types of evil and contrast that exists. I'm not trying to put it another way for an emotional or electrifying presentation. I think it would be pretentious and presumptuous after Atlas Shrugged has been written for anybody to say, well, now I'm going to really give you an exciting presentation of objectivism. That would be absurd. You couldn't possibly top Atlas Shrugged, and that has already been accomplished. I am trying for something very different, a deliberately factual, dry, unemotional presentation which will have only one attribute. It should be crystal clear. And my entire focus goes on that. Now, this upsets various people. Someone told me, well, they said, I really enjoyed The Ominous Parallels, but I don't find your book very thrilling. And my answer to that is, that is a compliment in terms of what I set out to do. It's not supposed to be thrilling. It's supposed to be thrilling only in the way that Euclidean geometry is. Now, I happen to think that that kind of presentation is thrilling, but it depends where you get your thrills. This is not offered as a rallying cry from the barricades. Ayn Rand gave that cry. If I'm modeled on anything, it's more modeled on the introduction to objectivist epistemology as style than on anything else. Now, in connection with that, let me say how I have treated polemics. That is, not simply, there's two elements in the book. The presentation of objectivism, which is about three quarters or more, and then the argument against the opponents of objectivism. Now, the more I've edited this book, I've edited eight times now, the more I have cut out polemics. After on the third or fourth editing, the polemics was taken out of the body of the chapter altogether and segregated in a little ghetto at the end of each chapter. And I found that if you do that, you just concentrate on the positive. By the time you get to the polemics, if you properly laid down the positive, the polemics take care of themselves. Now, this has to be contrasted with some people's idea of how you present objectivism, which is that the essence of objectivism is answering enemies of objectivism. Now, that, on the face of it, is completely untrue. Objectivism actually has something to say. It is not simply what's wrong with what everybody else has to say. It has a view of reality, of knowledge, of ethics, etc., which would be important, would have to be defined, elaborated, understood, whether or not there were opponents. So when we get to metaphysics, our concern is not what's wrong with God. When we get to epistemology, our concern is not how do you answer skeptics. What we want to know is what is there to say about reality, about knowledge, etc. In other words, basically the concern is what do we need to know on a desert island, in contrast to the approach of G.E. Moore. You know, he made this famous statement, "I don't think the world or the sciences would ever have suggested any philosophic questions to me. What has suggested questions is things other people have said about the world and the sciences." Now, that is a complete parasite in philosophy, and that is the opposite of the approach I'm trying to use. So let's leave the polemical discussions for when we get to the polemical sequences in each chapter. Now, in general, I would try to keep tabs of four issues in connection with any given point, because I try to do four things with each point. Explain its meaning is one. What does it say? For instance, if it's the primacy of existence, what does that say? And very often, what does it contrast to? Because the way to make it clearest is to say it says this as against that. That's the issue, that consciousness is differentiation. Therefore, to grasp something, you try to clarify by contrast. Then second, how do you validate that point? What does it rest on? How do you reduce it back to axioms or reality? And then third, some sort of applications, examples of the point, so it's not floating. If we're doing the primacy of existence, well, what would be an example of the primacy of existence? The man in front of the volcano, what would be an example of the opposite? And a variety of examples, if possible, not to multiply them, but to give an idea of the range of the issue. And then, equally crucially, four, integration. How does this point tie into the other key points of the philosophy? Now, of course, at the beginning, you don't have many to tie it into yet, but if it's the primacy of existence, I deliberately put in, how will this affect epistemology? Because that's going to be a crucial element, and you want to connect it. And then, of course, we're going to connect it to the issue of God, we connect it to the issue of causality, we connect primacy of existence when we get to ethics, to ethics. I get to capitalism, the big thing that I have to say about capitalism is it's the system of the primacy of existence. It has to run all the way through the philosophy. And I have to try to keep track, and you have to try to keep track. All the key points, which are highlighted for you by the subsection titles, how do they connect to all the others forward and back? And I will do that in the book and in answer to questions, but that's what will integrate it all and make a total. Now, a word about wording. Let's say I've edited this many times. By the way, I'm sorry to say that the copy you have has already been superseded, because I edited it one more time since you got this, and cut out a few more pages here and there of individual words and changed a few things. But it's only word cuts that you probably wouldn't notice much if you were read the final. But I have tried, within the limits of the possible, to weigh every word. And there's a lot of wording that was not in the lectures. that I think is a great improvement over them, and there's a lot of points that were never worded formally before in the objectivist literature, and I'll point out as we go. If any wording piques your interest or either clarifies or confuses you, please ask if you get a chance, because that will be maybe give me a chance to point out a reason for a certain choice, what kind of issue was involved, or clarify something for you. Now, I hasten to say that I cannot say every word is sacrosanct. I gave this to one beginning class, and the first question, or one of the questions I was asked is, well, why did you use start rather than begin? You said, where does a philosophy start? Why didn't you say begin? Well, of course, I could have said commence, inaugurate, initiate. There's too many synonyms in English to have a good reason for every one. So you have to ask this with a certain philosophic understanding. But if it's a philosophic term, I try to have a reason why. Now, as I say, you're free to ask about wording, but I have to ask you as a favor, group editing is impossible. So please don't tell me how I could have put it to make it clearer. Or say, well, why don't you put it the way you just said it, because that will be much clearer than the way you wrote it. In other words, you can ask any question you want, but don't rewrite it. Or if you want to rewrite it, don't show it to me. Editing by 300 writers, editors, is impossible. It would drive any author insane, because every reader has his own context. There is no formulation, not any, that would be clear to everybody, no matter what. Now, I, in this preliminary seminar, put certain things to the test. I was doubtful if they were advanced students mostly, and I was doubtful about one or two sentences, and I said, how many find this sentence clarifying? Whenever I tried that, one-third thought it was indispensable to stay in, one-third thought it was confusing and had to go, and the other third had no opinion. Now, you simply have to give up the attempt to please everybody. What a writer has to do is have in mind the exact state of mind that he is addressing. He has to know exactly what confusions he's writing for and what ones are outside the pale. And then he can edit only from the point of view of making it crystal clear to that exact mind. If that doesn't happen to be your state, it's not a failing on your part, but it's also nothing that I can do about in writing. That's one of the purposes of discussion, is to help clarify things that can't be made clear for everybody in strictly written form. I think myself that three editors is the tops any writer can accommodate. And that would be his editor at the publishing house, one colleague in the field that he highly respects, and his wife. And if you can get through those three, and that in itself is murder, then the rest has to stand or fall. Now, Ayn Rand used to say, I'm saying this in self-defense in advance, that anything can be read as unclear if you try. And of course, some people do try. She gave the example that I said to her, well, isn't A is A absolutely unimpeachable? Isn't that the clearest conceivable sentence a person could utter? So who could that be unclear to? She said, not at all. She said, if I were a modern, she told me this years ago, she said, if I were a modern analyst, I would say to you, A is A. Well, do you mean is like an octave, is eight notes, A equals A? Or do you mean like an apple is red? An apple has the attribute of red, A has the attribute of A? Or do you mean man is an animal? The entity belongs to a certain genus? Now, you don't, what do you mean, you see? So if you want to start confusing people, you can suddenly dissolve A as A into a what do I mean by is? And do I mean equality or genus species or entity attribute? And suddenly you don't know what A as A means. Now, That happens to be a completely corrupt point that I just made, because what fallacy did I just commit in saying, let's clarify A as A by reference to genus, species, or entity, attribute, or equality, or what? Yes, the Stolen Concept, or put another way, a hierarchical inversion. A is A is an axiom. It's that on which everything else depends. If you take some higher level information, like genus, species, or equality, or whichever, quantitative equality, and say, I'm going to use that to explicate the law of identity, you have inverted the entire order of knowledge and doomed yourself. You've made an axiom contingent upon higher level knowledge. Now, I'm trying to avoid that type of, let's put it in a friendly way, nitpicking. So ask whatever you want, but you have to leave me free to say I don't regard that particular question as illuminating, or even I regard it as out of order. Now, with that framework, I will take, when I get there, questions. I'll have to judge according to what's of general interest. And I'm going to have to be pretty cavalier about, you know, judging. This doesn't put any onus against your questions if I don't answer them. It simply means with hundreds of people, I can't take everything, and I have to judge lightning-like, is this, do I think, of general interest or not? If not, I'll just have to pass it by, and if we have time, which I doubt, we'll have more specialized questions later. I want to try to spread the questions around approximately one per period per person. So pick your best shot. You know, if you have a breathtakingly brilliant question, you can get another one, because after all, equality is not necessarily the standard. But let's try to spread them around as much as possible. And that's the only long-winded introduction. For each chapter, I want to start with a brief overview of what I regard as the points of interest in the overall structure, and then work through one section at a time. When we get to each section, I will point out to you the few things that I think are worthy of comment, and then I'll turn it over to you. Now, to get these things done on the time frame, I think we should allow approximately 30 minutes per section, and then whatever time, an hour or so at the end of the 4 hours, we'll throw it wide open to anything we missed. Now, do I have a timekeeper who can tell me when we're past 30 minutes? When we get there, it's not yet, okay? Now, I have, by the way, I don't think I'll take the time to do it now, but I have finally rewritten the, written the introduction to the book. It's not an introduction. It's the first 4 pages of this chapter. Somebody convinced me that if you want people to read what you write, put it at the beginning of chapter 1, because nobody reads introductions and prefaces. So I took what I had to say about the branches and the motivation of philosophy and stuck it right smack on page 1. So what you have really begins about page 5. But I won't take the time now to read you that, although I have it here. Let's plunge right into what we have. Now, a few brief orienting comments about this chapter as a whole. Subject is metaphysics, which, of course, is highly delimited. Can you actually hear me at this volume? I can't hear myself. A highly delimited subject for objectivism. Metaphysics is basically existence exists and all its corollaries. That's really what the subject consists of. In this sense, it's very different from epistemology, which is very complex, goes on for chapters, and there's a whole ramification of different issues. Ayn Rand always thought that the essence of philosophy is epistemology. Metaphysics is just like a prolegomena. It gets you started. And the whole thing reduces to there's something. Of course, you have to say it many different ways and connect it all, but that's what it comes down to. And once we say that, we turn right away to, well, where do we go from there? Now, you see why that has to be the beginning. until there's something, you can't get off the ground. So it has to be the first chapter. There could be no question of knowledge before you start with existence. Now, taking the things in order, obviously you have to begin with the axioms, existence, consciousness, identity, and their validation. I'll leave the text to speak for that. Notice the order philosophically. Existence, consciousness, identity. There is something, and right away implicit in that, I have to be aware of it, or I couldn't utter a tone. It is, and in grasping it, I am aware of it, and then the basic law, the law of identity, which is a law of existence and consciousness. Of course, consciousness is an existent, it's an element within existence, but identity tells you, in effect, gives you the definition, what is the nature, the most fundamental thing we can say about everything which exists, including consciousness. So it's existence, consciousness, identity. Now that's to be contrasted with the chronological order in which we reach these concepts. The philosophic and the chronological order are often different. You see that again in chapter 2 when we get to sensation and perception. The chronological order is sensation, perception, conception. But the philosophic order is perception, conception, sensation. I'm looking ahead to two. So those two are not the same concept. Now the chronological order, order in which we actually first in time learn these concepts, is existence. And then, as I point out in the second section, we have to grasp entity, which is a precondition of identity. On that basis, we then grasp a corollary, causality, which is a corollary of identity. I'm taking for granted you've read the chapter, so I'm not going to restate all these things. And only on that basis can we then come to grasp, even implicitly, come to grasp consciousness. So if we took just the three axioms, existence, consciousness, identity is the philosophic order, but existence, and then some more things, and then identity, and then some more, and then consciousness is the order in which we actually first learn them, even implicitly. Now, I treat causality relatively briefly because it is a not distinctive to objectivism. That is essentially the way the Aristotelian tradition treats causality, or at least would if it treated it, if it carried out fully what's implicit in Aristotle. Now, after that comes the primacy of existence. And I give more space to that because that's more distinctive to objectivism. Who can tell me why that has to come after causality? Obviously, causality comes after identity because it is a corollary of the axiom. But why must the primacy of existence come after causality? Logically, hierarchically. Why couldn't we structure the three axioms and then the primacy of existence and then causality? And this is a key point if you're to grasp the structure of the metaphysics, the structure of, of this foundation. Who would tell me that? Anybody know? Can you hear me?
So, that say that one depends on the other?
Can you be heard? Can you hear him?
No.
Now, if you're going to speak up, what do they do? Have to come to the mic or yell?
Yell.
Walter?
Stand up in front of the microphone.
Yes.
Stand up in front of the microphone,
Do you mean they have
please.
To come all the way from the back to the front to speak?
I think if they just stand up and speak clearly, they'll be heard.
Try standing up and yelling without moving.
Yeah. Depending is a form of action. To say that one depends on the other, you have to have the idea that causality.
Well, you're right. I would put it this way. The primacy of existence is an instance of the law of causality. It's an example of it. It's a concrete. Causality tells us entities act in accordance with their nature. And then the primacy of existence says, well, so does consciousness. It too has a nature. It too has to act in accordance with its nature. or to put it another way, the issue of the primacy of existence, I think you said this, pertains to action, to how things act, to what they do, what you can make them do or can't make them do. The primacy of consciousness, for instance, says you or the consciousness in charge can make things vanish, can make them change by wishing, can make them stay in existence or not. It says, in effect, consciousness controls the action of entities. Now, the primacy of existence says, no, that's wrong. Consciousness can't control the action of things. Why not? Because, well, that's the whole point. Why can't consciousness control the action of things? When I have a ball at the top of a tower and let it go, why can't my desire make it stay in the air?
Because
it has a nature, and its nature is what controls its actions. And what is that principle? Causality. So the real issue underlying the primacy of existence is the law of causality. It comes down to this. If the law of identity controls a thing's action, then your desire doesn't. And the primacy of existence says your desire doesn't affect existence. They are what they are independent of you. They do what they do independent of you. The reason? Because they are something, and therefore they must act that way. Therefore, the consciousness can be only a spectator. It can't change, alter, make things vanish. It can simply look out. That's the primacy of existence. So it is really a further application of identity once you've established the law of causality. Now, if you have the book here, I'd like to just point out in passing, I will point out a few passages that I think are helpful or new that might clarify something, and then we'll go to questions. Page 30. I just want to call your attention to that paragraph on the bottom of page 30. If existence exists, then it has metaphysical primacy. And that is a key point that struck me in the writing. By metaphysical primacy here, I mean that which comes first. Nothing precedes, nothing comes earlier, and therefore it goes all the way back. It's irreducible, immutable, unalterable. It's simply, nothing more can be said but this is where one starts. Now, every philosophy of any kind believes in something which has metaphysical primacy. There is no way not to start somewhere. If you're religious, for instance, you take God as the primary. If you're a pragmatist, and you say, for instance, reality consists only of experience, free-floating experience. Nobody doing the experience, an experience of nothing, just a stream of experience. Well, still the question is, did that experience come from somewhere or what? And if you push a pragmatist far enough, he'll end up saying, that experience just always was. There just always was, as Peirce put it, in the beginning was a chaos of depersonalized feeling. It just was there. That's it. And if you ask where it came from, you have to start somewhere. Every philosophy has to have a metaphysical primary. The question is, what is the primary? And the point I'm making here is, if you grasp the sheer idea that existence exists, with the fact that that means it's something, and it acts accordingly, you will see inherent in that that the world we see out there has to be the primary. It is not dependent on, it's not a derivative of, it's not an appearance of anything underlying it, like God or society or your desires, or it has to be the primary, and that is inherent in saying it is. So if you grasp the logic of the progression, you won't think it's two principles. One, existence exists. Two, it's irreducible. If you grasp existence exists, then you grasp it is. It's something, it's independent. Inherent in that is the starting point. There could be nothing earlier from which it comes. And therefore, its laws are immutable, its elements are uncreated and eternal. It's completely irreducible, and that's inherent in existence exists. The other thing I want to point out to you is on 39. This, I think, is a helpful new point. This is new to me. And that is the deepest metaphysical root of the mind-body dichotomy. Now, later in chapter 4, I discuss the epistemological root of this. But here, I think, I state very clearly, if I say, I have to pay myself an occasional compliment because I don't know how to point out something without saying this is clear or this is good. But on page 39, 40, 41 is what I want to just call out to your attention. The root of the mind-body dichotomy as I see it, that is why people have divided the world up into the spiritual at war with the material, the soul at war with the body. An idea which on the face of it is bizarre and absurd. How can a mind, which is a faculty of perceiving, be at war with the body, which is its instruments of perceiving? So it's an insanity on the face of it to make up two dimensions which are at war. But there is a real root, and I think that the root of it here is the idea of failing to, some people's failure to conform to existence. The desire for something which is contrary to reality. The desire, I want it no matter what it is, what Ayn Rand calls the I wish over the it is. And the key there is on page 40, the summation of this, let's call the middle paragraph there paragraph 2. The middle paragraph 2, the line there, whenever men expect reality to adapt to their wish, simply because it's their wish, they are doomed to metaphysical disappointment. Now, the key word there is metaphysical. You can often not get your desire, and you'll be just disappointed. You wanted a clear lecture, and the lecture isn't clear. You're disappointed. But a metaphysical disappointment is one where reality itself lets you down, where the actual, you feel existence itself has failed. And the result is what I call, which I think is a clarifying phrase, you bear a metaphysical grudge. Not just a grudge against the hotel for not providing ice water, but against the total of reality for not giving you what you want. Now, a rational person can have every kind of grudge imaginable, but not a metaphysical one. He can't ever feel metaphysical disappointment, because if something happens in reality, that is his standard. His attitude is, if it's there, I have to live up to it. I have to accept it. I have to adapt to it. It's up to me to conform to what's out there. So the only time he can form an expectation, a desire, a wish, is something that is not in the nature of reality, something that's open to human action and choice. Consequently, he can be unhappy, upset, miserable, but he can never feel reality as such as an alien dimension that let me down. On the other hand, if you accept the primacy of consciousness in any form, you accept the idea, I'm free, I have a license to assert my desires, and reality will fall into line. And then it doesn't. You're indignant. You were let down. That's why I think Plato's Timaeus is a perfect metaphor for this whole thing. And the result is you have right away my desire versus what's out there. The ideal meaning the world as I would have created it if I were God, versus the ugly, brute facts that I'm confronted with. The inner versus the outer. The moral versus the practical. That all of those are different aspects or angles of one basic clash which has a real source. And the source is a breach between certain people's consciousness and existence. Not just an error, but a willful turning away from existence as such in some instance. And I think, therefore, that the logical place, you see, to introduce the harmony of mind and body is right at the end of the primacy of existence. After you've said it's immutable, it's an absolute, you can't rewrite it, if you follow that line, you will experience the harmony of mind and body. Because the harmony is simply your experience of accepting reality, of saying, okay, it is, and I don't expect it to conform to my desire. And thus the last paragraph on 41. Okay, now let's try, can you time me now? 30 minutes. Let's start, that's by way of, I will be briefer hereafter, but I had to get all those preliminary things out of the way. In fact, let's take 3 minutes to, I'll catch my breath, and then we'll start in 3 minutes, okay? All right, I want to actually give you some time to ask questions, so let's start with the first sequence, only on that sequence. Would you come to one of the, how many mics are there? Four? One, two, three, four, and ask any question that you have. Yeah, somebody has to be first. This is on the first, would you want to, all right, come up. You want to come up to the mic? Just stand in line, I guess, at one of the mics, and I'll take turns.
This is a general question.
You can get right up, it won't bite you. Yeah. Go right into it, yeah. Just look into it, yeah.
Can you hear me now?
Closer, to put your lips like you're kissing it. Oh, it's dead?
I don't think it's working.
Try this one. Try this one. They told me they were all working.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Just don't worry about them seeing the back of your head. Just look in the
okay,
mic.
Okay, is this good?
Yeah.
Okay. This is a general question about what does metaphysical mean? I understand that it means before physics. That's how it came about. But the way you're using it is like it's an absolute in nature, not to be changed.
Okay. What does metaphysical mean? It does not mean before physics. Actually, the Greek means after physics, but that had to do with an accident of how Aristotle's works were organized centuries after his death. As objectivism uses it, metaphysics is the branch of philosophy which studies the nature of the universe as a whole. That's it. The nature of existence. It's not a specialized subject. It doesn't study any one subdivision of existence, only the totality. And it's not concerned to offer any practical guidance. It simply is the broadest study of the totality. And as I say, its essential content is existence exists. The rest is all just applications. Somebody else. Anything on the...
Can I say something?
Please.
I believe that the microphones are set up so that if you can, if you stand and speak loudly, it will pick you up.
Fine. Okay.
Okay, so that you don't have to run to the microphone.
Okay, good.
Please just stand in your place and use a little volume.
Yes. Why? I will do the back if you wave your hands, but I can't see.
Why is consciousness considered a metaphysical axiom, not or an epistemological one?
Well, why? Good question. Did you all hear that enough to repeat?
No.
Why? You didn't hear it?
No.
No.
Why is consciousness considered a metaphysical axiom and not an epistemological one?
That's a good question. All axioms, in a certain way, certainly all the ones in this chapter, are metaphysical. Because it's metaphysical insofar as you say that something is. It's epistemological insofar as you say it is a requirement of cognition. The distinction is between being and knowing. Metaphysics studies what is. Epistemology studies how you know. So if I said, for instance, consciousness is able to perceive reality, that would be an epistemological axiom. If I say the senses are valid, That's an epistemological axiom. But if I say we have the capacity of choice, that's an epistemological axiom. All of that is a precondition of knowing. But if I simply say this type of faculty is, even though it's a faculty of knowledge, I'm here not speaking of it in terms of how it gets to know, but simply that something is, and it's in that grounds that it qualifies under metaphysics. Metaphysics in that sense is an inventory of what is. Now, ultimately, only one thing is, namely existence. But it's very crucial for us, since we are the ones saying that it is, to say something else had to be, and that is our faculty of knowing. Now, later we'll say all the requirements of that, but as an inventory at the outset, it would be wrong to say there's reality. This is the totality. Now we get to chapter 2. Oh, I left out one thing that's very important, but I was saving it. You can't save an ingredient without which you couldn't speak at all. And the very existence of a faculty of knowledge comes into being the moment you grasp existence. You get that distinction? Okay, yell or come up?
Okay.
That's a good question. That's just the kind I like. Yeah.
Could you explain the relationship between logical and natural necessity according to objectivism? To what extent is
it? You're way ahead on another section.
Oh, but this is only a question.
I'm trying to take it on the first section only, on the primary, the basic axioms, existence, consciousness, and identity. So if you could follow the sections, you're way up on what you called logical and natural necessity. But since you asked, I don't think this one chapter is too hard to go out of order. But when I answer you, I want to stay hereafter within the sections. So wait till we get to them. There is no distinction in objectivism between natural and logical necessity. There is, in fact, only one use for the term necessity, which is otherwise useless. And that is to contrast the necessary with the chosen, as I say later. For instance, it is not necessary that we have this class today. It's not in the nature of reality. This is a volitional choice on the part of the conference people and me and you. It's not necessary. But it is necessary, once I pick up this paperclip and let it go, that it fall. That is nothing that's up to my choice. And that is the only legitimate use of necessary in philosophy, in contrast to volitional. And in that sense, is it logical? Certainly, that's logical necessity, because all logic consists of saying, what else must be given this? It rests on the law of identity, which itself is a fact of reality not open to our choice. Is it natural necessity? Certainly, it's part of nature. The whole attempt to distinguish logical, natural, or any other type of necessity comes from a modern, non-objectivist context. There's only necessity, and leaving aside the volitional, everything which is necessary. What is the point of having such a concept at all is simply to focus on one aspect. Identity tells us a thing is. Necessity tells us, given identity, it can't be otherwise. But it's simply a way of focusing on a fact from the point of view of it's governed by its nature, and therefore it's outside of our province of choice. It's a perspective on identity. That's why I say later, to be is to be necessary. So you can't distinguish so-called kinds of necessity. There is no problem of necessity. Now, that's out of order, but that's certainly worthwhile. Yeah, now you're going to go back to the first section, and you're marching on 30 minutes. Yeah.
This is a question on page 2 at the bottom.
Okay.
Talking about the concept of existence.
Yes.
And the second sentence says the concept does not specify that a physical world exists.
Right.
I don't understand that sentence, and maybe I can show you my problem. I would reword that sentence to say.
No, please don't. Just ask me what you think. Yeah.
Well, I would say the concept does not specify the physical world that exists.
No.
To me, that's
no. Please don't. Please
well,
don't.
Can you show me why I don't understand your sentence?
Well, my sentence is perfectly clear as stated, and you're doing just what I asked you not to do, so if you insist, I'll just have to insist that we're out of a stalemate. So rather than do it that way, just ask me what I mean, and don't tell me what would have made it clearer to you. Please, I ask you to follow that, because we just fight throughout the whole 2 weeks. You're not going to beat me down. The concept of existence does not specify any physical world, neither this one nor any other. It has nothing to do with the physical world. It doesn't say that there's a world even, let alone what kind of world it is. Existence has no content whatever, except it is. Not even it yet, because that takes us, see, I get my voice back when I get mad. That takes us to identity. All it tells us is what is available, I mean this literally, to an infant, a baby, or a savage in the moment that it opens its eyes. And the only way we could put that into words would be is. Even something is too specific, because something means as opposed to something else, and that's already identity. That's why you are ignoring what I said here. It covers only what is known by the gamut of the human race. This is, now for details on this, I'm going to refer you to some reading, which this is covered at length, and I'm going to use this in general. Thank goodness the new epistemology book is out, and there's a long, impassioned statement by Miss Rand there on why existence is not, as a concept, to be confused with external world nor with physical world, and what the distinction between those are, at what stages we reach those others, and why they are much higher and more derivative knowledge. She was very upset when someone in her epistemology seminar said, "Is existence exist the same as there's a physical world?" And she answered at length. So if that interests you, please read that. It's Harry Binswanger has a great appendix. You can find physical world under about four different letters. And if you read that, that is a very clear, but it's very important to grasp. You cannot import into philosophic axioms scientific knowledge. The concept of the physical or of matter is a high-level scientific discovery. It took many, many centuries to reach. And we still don't have a very clear concept of matter to this day. It's in chaos in terms of the state of modern physics. In any event, that is an entirely scientific development. Existence as the axiom of all philosophy and all cognition is entirely precedes any scientific development. Existence is what's available to anybody at any stage of knowledge, with or without any science. And therefore, when we say it is, that is all we mean. And you must keep that in mind. It means something crucial. What does it mean? I can't tell you in other words, because if I could, this wouldn't be an axiom. It wouldn't be irreducible. But given that you grasp it by opening your eyes, that's all it means. And then that you're aware of it. Here again, I don't say anything about it. Is awareness the faculty of a living organism? I don't even mention living organisms in this book till chapter 6. I don't say anything about the body or whatever here. As an axiom simply, you're able to be aware. Not how, but simply we know that it is, and you grasp it. If you didn't grasp it, you're out. Leave the room. You don't know anything. There's no you. But if you grasp it, you have a faculty of grasping. You have consciousness. And then, and one last thing, it's something. It is what it is. That's it. That's the total axiom. And they're all, as you see, inherent in grasping existence. So I meant what I said at the very back. Yes?
This is a question on wording.
Page.
Page 5, the first line of the last paragraph.
Differentiate means sets it apart from, distinguishes it from, separates it from. Now, if I have, look at my hand. If you're hearing this on tape, I have nothing on my hand. Now, if I put something on my hand, I say it is, as against, there is nothing there. Now, that doesn't make nothing into an entity. I don't mean I have a special kind of entity like this versus that. It is, it isn't. It is, it isn't. And that is a perceptual distinction, open directly to your awareness. And that is the most fundamental. When you open your eyes, you may not know what it is. You may have no idea it's an orange versus an apple. But when you grasp that it is, that's in contradistinction to the moment before when there was nothing. That doesn't mean you perceive the nothing, but it still distinguishes it from that preceding state.
My question is about the word differentiate.
Word differentiate means...
Doesn't this word usually distinguish one thing from another?
No, it does not. The word differentiate simply means makes a distinction, separates, leaves open what it differentiates from. If you're differentiating something from nothing, then there is no other thing. There's nothing is nothing, and you can't get me to make nothing into a something. You know, that there's two things, a something and then a nothing, and then we come and make a distinction. So the nothing is red, but the something is green. Nothing is nothing, but that doesn't alter the fact that there's still a distinction, a difference between my hand now, and then my hand now. Yes? No. Now, that is what I would call a differentiation, a distinction, something from nothing. I want to give the back of the room. Yes? I can't even hear you.
On page 2, you say that
can't hear you. He's coming up. Come on.
On the issue of metaphysical versus other types of grudges, suppose that you're very angry at man-made evil or irrational behavior of others, but for whatever reason, those others are in power at the present time. Is that a metaphysical?
No, it certainly is not. You suppose you're very angry at those in power. They're outside of your will, your control. Is that a metaphysical grudge? Absolutely not. Because they are not, thank God, inherent in reality. Now, if our leaders were inherent in reality, that would mean that by the very nature of what exists, George Bush had to be president. He would have the same status as the law of gravity. There's nothing anyone could do about it. He was just the inherent flow of electrons led to George Bush, and a universe without Bush would be no more possible than a universe without gravity or the solar system. Then, if that were the case, you would have no business being indignant. You see, because then you say, that's the nature thing. Of course, if that was the nature of things, that would mean that human life was impossible. So it would be a self-contradictory hypothesis. But a metaphysical grudge is one not against anything outside your will, but against reality. Here it's crucial to distinguish between the metaphysical and the man-made. Many man-made things are outside of your choice. So they're not up to your volition, but they are still something you can validly bemoan, protest, denounce. There's no mind-body dichotomy inherent in that. Unless you say, this is the way people are, it's hopeless, they control reality metaphysically, you see. They're in charge. I'm defeated. I'm doomed. I have no chance, whatever. Therefore, all I can do is retire into my soul and dream, about another world. But realistically, I'm lost. If you do take that course, then you are ascribing metaphysical power to the politicians. And then you will end up with a mind-body dichotomy, but that's not in the nature of the setup. Oh, this gentleman, yes.
Could you distinguish between the fact and concept of existence?
Sure. Yes. I will. Would you distinguish between the fact and the concept of existence? Yes, one is metaphysical, one is epistemological. One pertains to what's out there, one pertains to our grasp of it. Now, fact is a metaphysical term. When you talk about the fact of anything, you're speaking of its existence apart from any relation to man, to his consciousness, to his knowledge. That table is a fact. And similarly, existence is a fact, namely something is. And if we all went to sleep, something would still be. That's the fact. Now, the term concept designates one form in which a mind comes to know a fact. Concept formation is the subject of chapter 3. But it's a way of grasping a fact by taking a number of instances and integrating them into a unit and giving a term to it. So in that sense, the concept existence does not exist at the beginning. Only the fact does. Now, what does exist at the beginning is the implicit concept existence. And then maybe I'll say a word about that. Like that's right in this section, page 7. Again, in Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, Miss Rand has a lengthy discussion of the use of the term implicit. But I want to stress to you here two things. On the one hand, implicit knowledge is real knowledge. It does not mean merely potential knowledge. You can't stretch implicit to mean anything which any day I could come to learn, I now know implicitly. Because that would make implicit empty. It would be tantamount to the sum of human knowledge. It would be implicit in childhood. It doesn't mean potential. So if I don't know astrophysics, I can't say, well, I have the knowledge implicitly. I don't. I don't have it at all, neither implicitly nor any other way. So implicit knowledge has to be real knowledge. But when we say it's only implicit, it means we have not yet given it a linguistic status. We have not yet performed the integration and tagged it with a word. We have the elements of the knowledge, but we haven't yet processed it consciously into the form of a verbally formulated concept. Now, that is exactly what happens with the axioms. Take, for instance, existence. Now, the point of calling it implicit is, from the time you open your eyes and see that something is, till the day you die as an erudite scientist, you will never learn any more about the meaning of it is. There's no more to learn about that beyond what you get on opening your eyes. You'll learn all kinds of things about what it's made of and how things relate to other things and so on and so on. But about the primary meaning, it is. Whatever you get when you open your eyes is it. That's the total. That's the jackpot. And in that sense, that is real knowledge. It's as much as a scientist knows about the concept existence. So in that sense, it's real, not potential. But it's implicit because, obviously, a baby could not stand back and even in babyhood language, say the equivalent of, well, this is and this is and this is and needs something name the aspect from which they all are as against gremlins or George Bush's intelligence, etc., which aren't. And then let's call it exist and so on. Obviously, he can't do that. He can't do that separate act of focus, isolation, integration, and labeling, symbolizing, which is required to turn that implicit knowledge into an explicit concept. It's in that sense that he really lacks something crucial. And that's why savages, although they know existence just as well as you do, don't adhere to it in practice and go into all the different forms of magic because they have no way to stick by their knowledge because it simply is implicit. So there's two big differences here. Knowing nothing, knowing something explicitly, and knowing it implicitly. And the point is that axioms are known implicitly. And in that sense, animals get the axioms, or at least existence and identity, just the same way we do. They know as much about it is as we do. Only, of course, we wouldn't call it an implicit concept for a dog because he'll never have a concept. So it would be silly to say his concept is only implicit. He doesn't have conceptual information. But the knowledge, the basic data included in that concept, he gets as much as we do because there's nothing to get beyond what you get when you open your eyes. And the same for identity. Now, let me, once I have you here on page 7, point out what I think is an important paragraph on this topic. paragraph 3 about the tomato. The crucial point being that all axioms according to objectivism must be perceptual. Now, there are philosophers, rationalists are the famous examples, who believe, you might think listening to them that they are objectivists. They say, you got to start with axioms, and everything has to be based on axioms, and you have to proceed in a hierarchical structure, and axioms must be self-evident. And sounds fine, but their axioms are what they call intellectual self-evidences, or conceptual self-evidences. That is, they pertain to some ideas that they have somehow related in their minds. Do not rely on sense perception. Aren't validated by reference to sense perception. And of course, then a person can come up with anything he wants and say, well, it's self-evident to me. And somebody else says, well, it's not self-evident to me, and then you're lost. There's no objective basis anymore. Now, Ayn Rand's distinction here is to insist that an axiom is simply an abstract statement of what is given in perception. There is no such thing as an intellectual self-evidency or a conceptual self-evidency, if that's to be contrasted to a perceptual. An axiom is something that's open to your eyes and ears and is as available in that sense to an animal as to a man. And this is essential to grounding the axioms, to making it not an issue of argument or some special mystic intuition, but direct perception of reality. And I work it out here with one. When you perceive a tomato, how do you know it exists? It is. How do you know? You see it, that's it. There is no answer to that. There's no test, there's no proof, there's no argument, there's no theory. You look and you see. How do you know that it's something? That's identity. You see it. You see something as against something else. No argument, no proof, no way to convince anybody who claims he doesn't see it. And how do you know that you're aware? Which, in this case, aware of it? Because you are perceiving it. Just a form of being aware of it. You're perceiving. And that's it. There's nothing to say about these axioms except open your eyes and look. And the reason that there's nothing is because they are nothing but abstract statements, conceptual statements of perceptual fact. And from that point of view, there's nothing conceivably debatable about them, nor is there any way to argue for them. You can't do a thing about the self-evident except to say to somebody, you don't see it, you're in bad shape. It's simply your direct contact with reality. Ray.
Does that mean that the term axiom pertains only to metaphysics and to epistemology? And if so, when you get further down the line, what are the foundations called? Would that be principle or fundamental or what?
The term axiom, instead of asking his question and saying yes, I'll just state a declarative sentence and wherever possible. And you take it for granted that the question was, is this the case? Okay. Yes, I would not apply the term axiom anywhere in objectivism except metaphysics and epistemology. Only to things which are ultimately reducible to these three axioms. Every axiom of epistemology has to go back to the axiom of consciousness or the axiom of identity, which themselves go back ultimately to existence in the form that I discussed in this chapter. There are no axioms of ethics, not one. There's no axioms of politics, there's no axioms of aesthetics. Philosophy's axioms are exhausted, essentially, the basic axioms in this chapter. Now, I don't want to dogmatize about, for instance, mathematics. There are mathematical axioms, but that's a special science that's outside of our concern here. I would still, though, maintain that if those axioms are to be objective, they have to be ultimately reducible to perception. But that's up to mathematicians to worry about. But that's a good question, Ray, as far as philosophy is concerned. All axioms are perceptual, and all axioms are in the very foundation of the subject. There are no axioms of derivative branches. Yes?
If philosophy develops as a science, would the axiom be more or less universally accepted such as the axioms of mathematics?
No. You say philosophy develops as a science, would the axioms be universally accepted? It would be, they would be universally accepted by whoever approached them scientifically. But, you know, there's a lot of science today that exists alongside the most incredible primitivism. I mean, even here in the West, let alone around the world. So the existence of a science doesn't sweep all unscientific mentalities before it. I don't foresee the day, I mean, ever, in my crystal ball, that all of mankind will walk around announcing objectivism or even the axioms of objectivism. The most I can foresee in my most utopian is that there will be an island of civilization and that the level around the world will be raised by it. But I don't have that much, what would you call it, optimism or utopianism to think that one day everyone will go around saying A is A. I just don't think it. I'm not denying it, but I don't have a basis for it.
Properly understood, would they be like the axioms of mathematics applied to philosophy?
Well, what are you saying? If a person properly understands these axioms, would he accept them? Certainly. Even if he didn't understand them, he should accept them because there's nothing to understand. He should just open his eyes. I mean, why do you have to understand? If a person says, I can't say that is, I have to have a PhD first because there's so many senses of is, that's back to what I said at the beginning. Anybody who says, I need a long process of thought and clarification before I can bring myself, because I'm so scrupulous, to accept axioms is already screwed up. Because how is he clarifying? How is he straightening his thinking out? On what basis? He doesn't yet know anything is. He doesn't know that he's aware. He doesn't know that anything is anything. On what basis is he trying to clarify? So I have to take exception to your phrase, properly understood. Until you grasp these, there's no such term as properly understood. So don't have in your mind the idea, you know, like the Enlightenment, oh, if only we had education, you know, the axioms would be a real knockout. It's not true. You could educate people till they're dead. This is a purely volitional issue. To either accept reality or they don't. Now, you know, you can take away all of their evasions. But if you kill 100 evasions, there's just 200 more. It's like the ecology movement, you know. You can't keep up with it. You'd spend your whole lifetime refuting objections. That's why I think the last sentence was to cover that. Where is that? Yeah, on page 13. If reality without your help doesn't convince a person of the self-evident, he has abdicated reasoning, cannot be dealt with any further. And that's basically it. Now, I want to get to the next sequence before we end. I want to see if there was anything else. Oh, I want to point out for the... Yeah, I know it's up. I wanted to point out a couple of small things, and then we'll leave this sequence for now. If you notice that I was very deliberate with regard to each axiom, I covered both existence and consciousness, if I can put it that way, or being and knowing, with regard to each axiom. For instance, with regard to the existence axiom on page 2. I said, this has to be the foundation. First, there must be something, and one must grasp that there is. It has to be so, and you have to know it. An axiom is something which must be so, and you have to know it. It's a precondition of all future knowledge. So both those clauses apply to both axioms. For instance, on the next page, two-thirds of the way down, in regard to consciousness, before you can know anything, one must be conscious and recognize that one is. If you're completely unaware in any form that you're aware, then you can't ask any questions about knowledge. And the same is true of identity on page 6, near the top. Before you can ask about anything, it must be something, and you must know this. So they are axioms in the sense that they must be, and you must know them, all three. All right, let's, now, one last quick thing, and then we'll leave this on page 9. I'd like to stress that in paragraph 2, this whole section that's designed to show that even the enemies of an axiom have to use it in order to refute it. Do you understand clearly the point that this is not a proof of the axioms? I am not here, quote, refuting the enemies of the axioms. Why not? Yes, John. Because you cannot refute. You can't do anything until you accept the axioms. You can't even give this argument that anybody who denies them has to use them unless you yourself use them. You can't open your mouth without these axioms. Therefore, there can be no such thing as beating an opponent down into the ground. He will come back, just as I pointed out, you know, in the chapter, and say, well, you're counting on the axiom, which I don't accept. The purpose of this is not polemics. The purpose of this section is simply to show you that the axiomatic status is objective. In other words, when we give these three principles the status of axioms, that's not a matter of opinion. We can demonstrate that by showing that all other utterance, any other form of cognition, relies on these three. That's the proof that these three are at the base of all cognition and are therefore axioms. And in that sense, it's an objective demonstration. Not a demonstration that they're true, but a demonstration that they deserve the status of axioms because everything rests on them. But it's not a proof because that demonstration itself rests on the axioms. So this, I'm not here violating my rule of going into polemics, although it looks like it. All right, now let's go to causality as a corollary of identity. Yes. Genevieve, I can't see that far. Yeah.
You show identity, a basic axiom.
Yes. Yes, on page 14. If you will notice FN. FN means footnote. And this is the thing I have yet to do, which is write the footnote. There are certain points that I couldn't resist explaining, but they come under the heading of being so technical or so peripheral that they would destroy the reader's crow. So those points I'm collecting in the back. So I didn't write them yet, but this is just a reminder to me that they have to be written. In the final book, there will be no FN there. What'll be there is just a number, and the explanation will be given. But what it comes down to this. Entity is not universal, or at least we don't know that it's universal. It's not all-encompassing the way a basic axiom has to be. Existence, for instance, covers everything, absolutely everything of any kind, type, or description. Consciousness covers your awareness of anything, regardless of its nature. Identity, it is what it is, no matter what. Those three are completely unrestricted. Entity is a specification, a narrowing. Entity is what Aristotle called a category of being. It's like entity versus action, quality, quantity, etc. Now, if you remember in chapter 2, I left open, what will scientists someday discover about the ultimate nature of the universe? Maybe it's all little, what do I call it? Meta-energy. Now, I deliberately gave no definition to that, even to saying that it's entities. I didn't say it's little particles, nothing. Don't ask me to hypothesize, I have no clue, but I strongly believe philosophers should not dogmatize about science. So I'm even leaving open the possibility, not a possibility that we have a basis for, but simply I'm not foreclosing, that when we reach omniscience, whatever the ultimate meta-energy is, it won't be describable by the term entities. That'll still be something. But don't ask me what category would come under. I haven't a clue. If I had a clue, you know, I would be lecturing on physics. So the point is, of course, that has no philosophic significance, nor does it undermine entities in the world that we perceive for the reasons that's discussed in chapter 2. But it's to leave open, it's because a basic axiom has to be entirely unrestricted. An entity in that way has a specification. It's more narrow. It's a type of, a form of existence, put it that way. It certainly is an axiom. We couldn't go anywhere without it. And to human knowledge, it's a basic axiom. But it's not basic in the way that these others are inherent in any reality cognized by anyone. You see the difference? It's in that sense. Now, there are many other concepts that have yet to be categorized besides entity, such as action. And there's a whole bunch of, you know, you could do, which I won't, but somebody should, in effect, an analysis of the primary concepts. What are the basic and what are, you know, more narrow, what are applications? There's a whole family tree there to work out. But I just put that in here because I wanted to clarify the point. If this is a precondition of getting to identity, and identity is so basic, why the hell don't I put this back under my axioms to begin with? You see, so I had to at least give you a hint that this doesn't have the same status as existence, consciousness, and identity. Unfortunately, a hint is all I can give you. But does that clarify to the extent? Yes. If you wave near the back, I can see motion. Yeah. Now, you're supposed to try to do one a shot, yeah, one a period. Go ahead.
I'm not entirely sure if this falls into this category. I don't think it does. Basically, axioms.
We're under causality now. Anything from pay? What?
Maybe I'll give it a shot at it.
All right, try and see. Well, you want me to distinguish philosophy and science, is what it comes down to. But you want me, if I gather from your wording, to do it in such a way that you will know immediately whether something you're saying is science or whether it's philosophy. And there is no distinction that I can make that will be automatic, so that you can just quickly say, ah, well, I won't ask this because this is science, as opposed to philosophy. The best way I can put it is this. This is the way Ayn Rand put it. Philosophy is universal. Metaphysics, for instance, is concerned with everything. As soon as you have to get down to something in particular, this thing as against that, matter as against mind, stars as against the earth, fruit as against vegetables, you're outside of philosophy. It has to be all-encompassing and universal. That's true also for epistemology. You can ask any questions about how does one know anything. You have to use the senses, you have to use concepts, you have to use logic, but as soon as you get to how do you know the laws of physics, then you're in applied epistemology, you're in the philosophy of science. And that's like a cross between philosophy and science, but that is not philosophy in the pure sense that we're discussing it here. So when you get into the detail of any particular type of existence, that is science. Philosophy, Ayn Rand used to say, has to be that which basically anyone could know in any civilization at any stage of knowledge. It should not require specialized knowledge. It should not require knowledge that Galileo provides for us, or Newton, or Einstein, or biology. We should be able to do the basic, certainly the basic principles of philosophy, just on the basis of being a human being, adult, able to speak, looking out at reality. As soon as you get more specialized than that, then you're outside of philosophy proper, unless we're talking about a highly specialized thing within epistemology, like the theory of concept formation. That's obviously highly specialized. But that's right on the question of how does one acquire knowledge. And therefore, that's within epistemology. Okay. Yes?
On page 4, it says the consciousness conscious of nothing than itself.
Well, you're going back to the first section now. I'm trying, if possible, to move from section to section. But all right, go ahead.
Contradiction in terms of how is that validated at this point and not later after concepts of consciousness? Second introspection.
Well, how is the sentence from Ayn Rand on page 4, a consciousness conscious of nothing but itself is a contradiction in terms? Why doesn't that require concepts of consciousness? Well, look, the whole chapter requires concepts. You can make a point that you need, and in fact this is true, that's why I quoted from Hegel. Oh, you didn't get that part. The true is the whole. Without concepts, we couldn't speak. So you could argue that if we didn't have concepts, we couldn't do any part of this. Without logic, we couldn't think. Without percepts, we couldn't perceive what is. Without values, we wouldn't be here. So if you want to argue it that way, every sentence in this chapter rests on the entire book, as does every sentence in any chapter. That's what we mean as a philosophy as a totality. But that does not alter the fact that although we have to use language, use logic, use reason, use our senses, this is not the point to present or define or validate those. There is still a structure of the order in which we acquire knowledge. And we have to start with that there's something that we're able to know it. We have a faculty of knowing it. Even though we have to use concepts to name that, that information is given us directly. Now this point here is that you singled out is simply Ayn Rand's point that anybody who uses consciousness while denying existence is contradicting himself. He's wiping out the term consciousness. Consciousness, remember, is a primer. It's simply that state of awareness. You get it by, remember, a perceptual self-evidencing. How do you get it? By being aware of the tomato and grasping your state of awareness as you focus on the tomato. And that's what awareness is. And that's what we as adults call consciousness. Now, if somebody comes along and says, get rid of the tomato, now what do you got left? Nothing. That's it. Awareness without anything, there's no awareness. That's not arguable. It's simply you're contradicting the term, because the term simply denotes the state. And the state, by its nature, is simply the grasp of something. Take away the something, the grasp is gone. That is simply inherent in the percept. That is what she would call implicit awareness. She is here simply pointing that out. You don't need to develop concept formation to know that. You need to have concepts to say it. But to learn it originally, you just have to open your eyes. In the act of looking, you grasp that you can't look without looking at something. That's inherent in being aware. That's all that she's saying. A consciousness conscious of nothing is gone. And it wipes itself out. You're contradicting the term, because awareness is that state that you have when you're aware of the tomato or whatever. So I hope you get this point, because you're going to be very confused hierarchically. In fact, I sympathize with you in a way, because when I first wrote the book, I felt that everything had to go in chapter one. Because I kept thinking, well, you need concepts to say this, and you need, you know, but it isn't true. You need all of this to say it, but that still leaves open the order of logical development. First, there has to be something. Although I need the total of objectivism to name that axiom, it still came first and enabled me to grasp the rest of objectivism. And that is the hierarchical structure you have to grasp. Now, I'd like to go back and deliberately focus only on any questions in this. If we don't do this, as I know from experience, we'll just jump all over and we'll end up that whoever, you know, giving no time at all. Now, I'm supposed to be spreading this around, so try to the last minute, only people who have not yet spoken. Yes.
Could you give an example of reducing an entity that's considered in the extended sense to aspects of entities in the primary sense? For example,
give me which page you mean.
What's that?
Where are you? Oh, I see. On page 14?
Yeah.
You're thinking of the sentence near the bottom of 14, all entities are reducible ultimately to combinations, components, or distinguishable aspects? Yeah. Well, I have in mind there, see, the term entity is used in 1,000 different ways. There again, Ms. Rand has a very helpful, did you read her discussion? She has a very helpful discussion in the epistemology book of entity, which that's my footnote as to her discussion, because it's as, you know, as long as one of these sequences or longer. you can call a square foot of ground an entity. By in derivative usage, you can call everything. But I'm trying to cover everything. Now, for instance, combinations. I have in mind they're like General Motors, you see. Or even in certain contexts, the universe is a totality of things. But we can't grasp General Motors, to take that example, until we first grasp the president, the vice president, the office furniture, etc. So you first have to grasp in the primary sense the entity, the direct person. And then you can use entity for combinations. Similarly, components. We know from science, for instance, that the body is made of organs, which you can take, pull out, and that's an entity. Or the organs themselves are made of molecules and atoms. And we can maybe see those through an electron microscope or something. But again, we couldn't reach that stage before we first grasped entity in the primary sense. Now, I put distinguishable aspects as a third in to cover all the miscellaneous that is not obviously either a combination or a component. For instance, the sky. Now, the blue sky is something. You can perceive it. And you can refer to the sky as an entity in a certain context. Now, it's not in an obvious way, like General Motors, and it's not a bunch of constituents. I would analyze that as simply, it's the atmosphere, the way we perceive it, the way light is refracted and so on. So it is really an entity. But it's not an entity in the obvious way that I say here with a definite perceivable shape. So in this regard, we would have to stand back and look at the total Earth as you would see it from space as the entity. And then the blue sky would be an aspect, a distinguishable aspect. And the same for a foot of ground, which you can call an entity. It's not a sum or a component. The reason I put this in only is because philosophers are very, even though I'm not engaged in polemics, you want to try to cover yourself against as many shysters as possible. Now, you can't really do it, because it's infinite. But the first thing that they will say if they see a sequence like this is they won't touch causality. They'll destroy the concept of entity. Because, of course, if that goes, causality is gone. And the way they do it is say, well, you say things I directly perceive, but I don't see the things you say. All the things I perceive are blue sky, and then he'll say, I hear the noise of a symphony. It has no, quote, definite perceivable shape. He'll give you every weird thing that you encounter and say, you're prejudiced to pick on what you call entity out of the richness, of reality. So I'm trying to show here briefly that any one of these alleged other things that you pick out of reality will reduce one way or the other back to entity in the primary sense. So thank you for pointing that out. You see what you have to cover yourself against everything. But for a detailed discussion, Ms. Rand, she even allows in there that society is an entity in a certain context, which really upset me at the time she said it, but that's 20 odd years I've grown since then. This is supposed to be your one shot today. Yes, right. Does action include non-physical action? Yes, absolutely. Action includes any process or activity. If a consciousness engages in an action, certainly that action has a cause. If you, and in fact, in the next chapter, one of the sequences is human actions, mental or physical, as caused. So if you, for instance, think about something, that's a mental process. It has a physical correlate, which is the structure of your brain, the process of your brain. But it's still a mental process, a process of consciousness. That has a cause. And the cause is, first of all, you as an entity combined with particular values you hold, particular knowledge you hold, a particular decision you make, and all of that issues in, leads to a certain mental process, which is how you act. So action is not restricted under causality to physical action, not at all. Does that answer?
Maybe I'm just confused, but that action implies some kind of a motion or something acting on it.
No, action is a broader term than physical motion.
Okay.
action is a primary. It's like entity. You can only grasp the concept by observing actions. Then you just have to see something happening. It doesn't yet say what kind of happening, in what stage, on the physical world or in consciousness. It's the broadest, I can't put other names for it because you have to start somewhere. Any occurrence, any event comes under the broad category action, happening, see? We have all kinds of words in English to denote shadings of that, but it all comes down to, you know, a happening, something going on. Yes?
I've already asked something.
Well, let's give somebody else a chance because we just have a few. Okay. Can't hear you.
Would you say that inherent in the concept of action would be necessarily an element of time?
Of time?
Yes.
No, not inherent. What I say inherent in the concept of action is the concept of time, not in the concept. Time is a very sophisticated concept. Time is a complex type of relationship to motion that you would have to be far advanced, relatively speaking, to grasp. Action is something you would grasp implicitly at the very beginning, before you even grasp causality. You would have to grasp event, occurrence, before you could grasp the idea that an entity acts in accordance with its nature. You'd first have to grasp that it acts. So in that sense, the concept of action is far earlier than the concept of time. Now, if you ask me, does every action take place in time? I think yes, but that's a confusing way of putting it, because time is not a Newtonian dimension, you know, in which action occurs. Time is a type of relationship. And we can measure the temporal duration of anything within a limited system, of any action, of any entity, of any quality. So you're not clarifying anything by thinking of it in those terms. Now, I want somebody new for the last while here. Yes?
Would it be proper to say that the cause of an action is a combination of the nature of the entity as well as antecedent factors, or is that...
Yes, no, of course. When you define it fully in a scientific way, you can't just say an entity is the cause of its action, because the entity, for instance, this microphone is here, but it's not active. So it has to be the entity in a certain state of affairs, in a certain set of circumstances, which really means the entity in conjunction with whatever other entities are present. You see, the entity by itself doesn't just start to act. If I take a simple example, if I have an egg, it can just sit on the counter forever. It won't, you know, start to do anything. But now if I pick up the egg and put it down on a frying pan, if the frying pan is cold, it'll just sit there. But if the frying pan is hot, it'll start to sizzle. Now it still is the entity acting because of its nature. Obviously, if I put an ice cube down, it wouldn't sizzle. So the nature of the entity is the cause, but it's the nature in a certain set of conditions, which means, given what I did, what the frying pan did, you know, given that it's on the surface of the earth, what the earth is doing, every entity interacts with every other. So the full cause, if you really wanted to, you'd have to give the total state of the universe, all the entity, but of course, for purposes of cognition, we just abstract the major ones that are involved. But you're right, the cause is not simply the entity in a vacuum, it's the entity in its context, in its metaphysical context. Let me see if I had any brief points that I wanted to. I want to just call a few points to your attention here as we leave this section. On page 13, notice that on that first paragraph in the section, it said, to grasp identity and later consciousness even in implicit form. In other words, even though these are axioms, in the very first act of consciousness, you don't even have them implicitly. To reach the awareness of something as against something else, you have to progress enough that you can bring two contents together and say, oh, this versus that. And that's a later stage, perhaps months after you're born. And then to get to the stage where even implicitly you can look in and distinguish your consciousness from what you see is a still later stage. So here again, implicit knowledge means real knowledge. And even the axioms, the only one you literally have from the moment you open your eyes is existence. The other two you get within a few months. Now, what else? Oh, I want to call to your attention what I think is a page 16, a bit of an improvement in the treatment of causality. This is in my new inductive incarnation. This is a deliberately inductive indication of the validation of causality, not a deductive. In the old days, I used to present causality as you would deduce it from law of identity, and entities are the ones that act, and then I would go through a whole complicated chain of deduction. And I now avoid and eschew that method altogether, because I'm going back to the way that a child actually grasped it. That's what we're supposed to be doing here, is reconstructing the foundations of knowledge as you actually grasp it from percepts. And the way you would actually grasp causality is not by hearing an abstruse demonstration about the corollaries of identity. And therefore, if we're trying to validate it, we have to recreate the way we actually grasp its truth. And thus, on page 16, you shake your rattle, you push the ball, you let the block fall. That's the actual material in reality of causality. That's the observational, perceptual, inductive data. And then, after a while, if you're not retarded or a human, you get the implicit message. It's only implicit because you don't have language yet, but you get the idea. Certain things do certain things and not others. That's it. They act one way and no other. And it's at that point that the child has causality. He has it, for practical purposes, implicitly. And then in the next paragraph, when we give the formal validation, we're not giving any special proof. We're just putting in conceptual terms what we already perceived in all these instances. So I think, to me, that makes the validation of causality clear. Now, there's a case on page 20 where I have a purely polemical paragraph. Now, ideally, you wouldn't include that on Heisenberg, but given the world today, I didn't think I had a choice. So I threw it in and threw it out fast, you know. And the only last thing I will say in our last minute, I happen to like this last, on page 21 sentence, cause and effect is not a metaphysical afterthought. That, of course, is directed, that's a sort of a polemical, against all of people who say, well, we have the world, now how do you explain the fact that it's orderly? You know, we've got the world, what do we have to add to it to explain its order? And my point is that it is not some additional thought. It's not something, and now we've got a further explanation. Inherent in being is that it's something, and therefore must act a certain way, therefore causality. And if you ask, I thought this was a good point, well, where did law come from? You're really asking what caused causality. And that is, on the face of it, the most absurd question you could ask. If he caused causality, what caused the causation? And then you're going to have an infinite regress. So causality has to be irreducible. You can take it to identity, but you can't find something over and above existence. All right, tomorrow we will do the rest of one. First we'll take the last sequences, and then the chapter as a whole, anything you have. Thank you very much.